Back, everyone, with our next case, United States versus Mendoza. Captain Fields, are you prepared to argue on behalf of appellant? And Captain Scarpati, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government?
Yes, Your Honor.
Very well. Please proceed.
Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, may it please the court, appellant requests to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
The legal inability to consent is not the equivalent of the government bearing the affirmative responsibility to prove that the victim did not consent. Just as sexual assault when the victim is too incapacitated due to intoxication is not the equivalent of sexual assault without consent. This court should look to its precedent in Riggins and in Sager, where it said each statutory provision must stand on its own, and determine that the facts offered by the government in this case fall short of the affirmative proof necessary to prove sexual assault without consent.
But Captain Fields, didn't Riggins also say that often with in a inability to consent and a without consent case that there will be evidence that overlaps? So what are we to make of that?
Your Honor, the evidence that can overlap for an intoxication case has to be something different than the affirmative expression of a lack of consent through words or conduct. There are limited circumstances where alcohol can apply to the words or conduct necessary to offer that affirmative proof. And I'll give the court an example. For example, if two people are in a room together and one person says, I don't want to have sex with you, and the other person says, oh, you don't mean that, just here, drink more, that would be a case where alcohol could apply to a without consent case. But otherwise, to honor the surplusage canon and this court's ruling in Sager, these two things must mean separate things. Otherwise, the statutory provision is a complete overlap. And that's the problem with the government's argument, Your Honor, that the overlap is total. There's not a set of facts that the government can offer that would only be prosecutable under a incapacity theory. In every case where the government could charge incapacity, they would also charge without consent. And that only works towards without consent. They wouldn't suggest that the expression of no would be relevant to incapacity. It all flows only in one direction and makes every other statutory provision surplusage of without consent. The Supreme Court, in a recent case in Dubin, said that the meaning of a criminal statute doesn't turn on the broadest possible interpretation that the government wants to offer. Allowing without consent to subsume all other statutory provisions is that broadest possible reading of the statute. Similarly, the government offers a case like Batchelder to claim that the government is actually permitted to charge two different offenses when they're similar. In Batchelder, those were prohibiting exactly the same conduct. Appellant's point today is that these
To be fair to the government, weren't you arguing something different in your brief? Not that you couldn't charge under both, but in your brief, weren't you arguing that if there are two statutes that could have been charged, the government had to charge the most specific offense?
Yes, sir.
And I think that's what the government's point was.
I agree with that, Your
Honor. That you said that, but that's not what the Supreme Court is saying in Batchelder.
In Batchelder, a case involving the sentencing guidelines, when you're prohibiting exactly the same conduct, and that's the distinguishing factor between the specificity canon in Simpson that we offer to the court and Batchelder that the government offers, is that in Batchelder, prohibiting exactly the same conduct, which was a felon in possession of a firearm. Appellant's point today is that sexual assault without consent criminalizes when the victim expresses non-consent, and sexual assault by incapacity due to being incapable of consent criminalizes the legal inability to consent, and that's what appellant offers this court was saying in Riggins. And despite Riggins addressing a bodily harm theory, but having the same consent definition, even when Congress dropped the bodily harm theory and moved to without consent, they kept that definition, which included the requirement that an expression of lack of consent through words of conduct is what means there is no consent. And if you look at the government's facts, and they say that incapacity is just circumstantial proof of a lack of consent. That was also what the government offered at their 917 motion at trial to survive the motion to dismiss. The issue with that is it becomes the entire theory, and it allows for an end run around this court's precedent in Pease. In Pease, and which was adopted by Congress when it separated out incapable of consenting in 120G8, required that the government prove that the victim was so incapacitated due to alcohol that they couldn't make or communicate a decision. When the government doesn't believe it has enough proof to meet that standard, it says, well, okay, we don't have to meet Pease. We'll just charge without consent and offer a high level of intoxication, but not such a high level to prove incapacity that we can offer without consent.
The counsel doesn't, now it's, looks like my microphone fell off. I'm sorry. The Army Criminal Court of Appeals in Roe said that the government may carry its burden of proving sexual assault without consent by presenting both the evidence of intoxication, and they use the term, alongside other evidence. So is it your position that the government can never meet its burden in that way? Is Roe incorrect?
Your Honor, I think the alongside other evidence is doing a lot of work in Roe, and it's not present in this case.
Okay.
I think that to the extent that there is an expression of a lack of consent made at the time of the sexual assault, then when you add in the other facts, for example, in this case, the government offers the fact that the two were strangers. That is circumstantial proof, but it doesn't get you to the affirmative consent. And none of the circumstantial evidence in this case make up for the lack of that affirmative proof. Roe might have had more than this case, but it is totally lacking in this case, and that's why this case is the paradigm example of how the surplusage issue is total.
Counsel, on that point about surplusage, is there a principle that if there are two offenses, one general and one specific, that the government has to, if the facts would fit within, the allegations fit within the specific, the government has to charge the specific offense? And is there such a principle, and what would be the best authority for such a principle?
So I think Simpson came close to suggesting that, but I would agree, Your Honor, that it is not the most in vogue, it's not the most salient statutory construction canon. The problem is that if you apply all of the canons of construction to this case, including specificity, it would require that these statutory provisions be separated out. So
I'm not hearing an answer to Judge Maggs's question there. In your brief, you say, quote, it's on page 15, quote, where a general and a specific statute speak to the same concern, a prosecutor must charge the more specific statute. What do you have that supports that?
That was my reading of the Supreme Court's decision in Simpson, Your Honor. And the government highlights how that's distinguishable because it was looking at a sentencing enhancement. That came from language from the United States Supreme Court looking at the specificity canon. But I am conceding that the specificity canon doesn't do all the work in this case. If you apply the surplusage canon first,
you no longer adhere to that argument.
Oh, Your Honor, I do adhere to that argument.
That the government is compelled, if there are two statutes and the actions of an accused would fit under either statute, the government is compelled to charge that person under the most specific statute.
Your Honor, I think the Supreme Court's case in Simpson, and then again most recently this past year in Dubin, suggests exactly that. In Dubin, the issue was a simple Medicaid fraud case was charged as aggravated identity theft. And the court was concerned that they were charging identity theft because of its sentencing enhancer, despite identity not being a crucial issue to the case. And they looked at the title of identity theft and determined that, in that case, identity should be crucial to the crime. Here we have two different statutory provisions, one criminalizing sexual assault without consent, and one criminalizing sexual assault when the victim is intoxicated. And despite, in this case, having what almost amounts to a confession by appellant to sexual assault when the victim is incapacitated, the government still charges sexual assault without consent, despite that very compelling evidence that they could have proven incapacity.
I'd like to raise another point from your brief. On page 6 of your brief, you write, the government introduced no evidence that the alleged victim displayed affirmative non-consent at the time of the sexual act. And then on page 13, you write, Article 120B1, without consent, means affirmative non-consent. Is it your position that a victim must affirmatively display their non-consent, or what you were trying to say there is that the government bears the burden of affirmatively proving a lack of consent?
The government bears the burden, Your Honor, that the government bears the burden to prove, as it says, that Congress wrote in 120G7A, an expression of a lack of consent through words of actions is what means there's no consent.
There was another point in your brief that struck me. Nowhere do you cite Senior Judge Walker's dissent. Senior Judge Walker's dissent fully supports the appellant, would result in the same remedy. Do you disagree with Senior Judge Walker's dissent?
Oh, certainly not, Your Honor. I think that was simply a decision that was a dissenting opinion and was not the majority opinion of the lower court. And so it was a decision as to how persuasive that citation would be to this court. But we agree. I believe Judge Walker's reasoned analysis on this court's decision in Sager, where it said that asleep, unconscious, and otherwise unaware have to mean separate things. If you look at this statute, it's not just the punctuation and different wording at issue in this case. There's separate enumeration, separate definitions, and obviously separate wording. If this court is going to be consistent with its opinion in Sager, then these statutory provisions have to mean different things too and can't be mere surplusage of each other.
So there's no daylight between you and Senior Judge Walker?
No, Your Honor. I think that we add on to with other points, but we agree with Judge Walker. Yes, Your Honor. Your Honor, I think that if this court does not address this issue, there are other issues like notice, and I think that was one of the concerns, again, of the Supreme Court in Dubin. I believe that court was even looking at what the person who commits the offense knows that they're doing at the time that they're doing it. And in that case, it was Medicaid fraud. Just like in this case, it seemed like appellant was very concerned that he was committing a sexual assault when the victim could not consent, but he wasn't very much concerned that she did not consent. If you look at his statements to CID, as I say, amounted to confessions, and then look at the government's charging decision, it becomes unclear why they would charge without consent, but because they think that it's easier to prove than incapacity.
Is there another problem that arises when you have a situation like this regarding what kind of defense might be considered by the appellant and his counsel? In other words, here, sexual assault without consent, would you agree, is a general intent crime? And, of course, sexual assault with one incapable of consenting has the extra element of knowledge on the part of the perpetrator, rendering it a specific intent crime. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
So isn't there an issue regarding the defense of mistake of fact? And in fact, if the government is allowed to proceed and prove up consent or sexual assault without consent by means of showing that the individual was simply incapable of consenting, aren't they avoiding the issue of knowledge in the offense that we've just mentioned? And doesn't that pose a problem? Does that put a burden on the defense to have to prove something that the government would have to prove if, in fact, they had charged the other offense?
Absolutely, Your Honor. To add on to what you said, Judge Sparks, it also eliminates the voluntary intoxication defense. It changes what types of and the usefulness of experts, because if they were actually defending against an incapacity case, all they would have to prove is that the victim was not so incapacitated. They don't need to prove consent one way or the other. But when it's charged without consent, but tried by the government as an incapacity case, the fact that they might disprove the incapacity doesn't get them all the way to an acquittal, because they still haven't defeated the without consent issue. So it puts the defense on its heels to not know exactly how they're going to try their case. And I think that that was some of the work that this court did in Riggins. For the government, my take on the government's argument is that these are essentially kind of pseudo-lesser includeds of each other. But they're not. They're separate statutory provisions, each requiring the government to prove different elements, and also offer the defense different avenues to defend the case, all of which are taken away if it's just simply a without consent case. Pending any other further questions?
Any further questions from the bench? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you. Well, can I just ask one more question?
Absolutely.
I'm sorry. Could you have sought a bill of particulars from the government asking how do you intend to prove, what are the facts that are going to show without consent? And if the government had said, well, too incapacitated to consent, would that have eliminated all these other concerns?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because that's essentially what happened here later time in the trial, in the 917 motion. When the defense moved to dismiss, they say they haven't proved affirmative non-consent. The government hasn't proven that. And they say, oh, we don't have to. It's an incompetence case. And therefore, they also added incapacity. I see my time is up.
Please proceed.
They offer that it was an incapacitation case where she was actually incompetent, and therefore that's all we need to prove. So I don't think that a bill of particulars would have solved the issue, because it still takes away the voluntary intoxication defense. It still changes the types of experts and the usefulness of the experts. So even knowing in the beginning exactly how the government was going to prove it doesn't solve the issue.
Any further questions? Seeing none, thank you.
Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, may it please the court. My name is Captain Tony Scarpati, and I, along with Christopher Burgess, represent the United States. This court should affirm the findings and sentence because appellant's conviction was legally sufficient. As this court's well aware, the standard for legal sufficiency is a very low threshold to sustain a conviction. Any rational fact finder could have found all the elements of the offense beyond a reasonable doubt based on the evidence presented at trial. As this court's well aware, it's obligated to draw every reasonable inference in favor of the government. Here, there was an abundance of reasonable inferences through circumstantial and direct evidence that did not consent to the sexual acts with the appellant. This case comes down...
All those points are fine and good, but I'm trying to figure out how you would have us reconcile your approach with our decision in Sager. So in Sager, we said quite clearly that we have three distinct theories of liability there. Talking about asleep, unconscious, otherwise unaware. And there we had a situation where it was a single enumerated provision of Article 120B. And each of those three of asleep, unconscious, or otherwise unaware was simply separated by commas. And yet we said three distinct theories of liability. Here, we've got separate enumerated provisions that are separated by semicolons. So just in terms of the way that courts approach statutory construction, how would we reconcile Sager with your approach here?
Yes, Your Honor. Firstly, I'd like to point out that the facts of Sager are different in the sense that the government charged all three theories under one specification. And essentially what happened was the verdict returned a general verdict where all three of those charges were affirmed, yet the CCA did not know which one to apply. And in doing so, merged all three theories into one. In this case, the CCA specifically looked at the different theories, acknowledged that they were distinct theories, cited Riggins and cited it for that proposition, and yet found that evidence that supported one theory could also support another theory. Here, the government charged one theory without consent, and the appellant was convicted of that very theory. So the difference here is that there was no issue of notice, there was no issue of a general verdict, such as in Sager, and the CCA did not interpret the legislative words to all mean one single theory of liability. They merely acknowledged that some overlap is, of course, very common in criminal law, and that's a fact that the Supreme Court has acknowledged time and time again, especially when dealing with offenses as similar as the ones here.
Counsel.
Okay. Oh.
Thank you. We might accept as a logical matter that proof that someone could not consent is ipso facto proof that they did not consent. But I think the appellant's position is that as a legal matter, if you have a general statute and a specific statute, you have to charge it under the specific statute. Do you agree that that's a principle of law?
No, Your Honor. I think that that principle is mentioned under certain circumstances. However, if you follow those cases, specifically the state cases that appellant cites for that proposition who adopted Simpson, the state cases as recently as 2023 distinguish that it's specifically when Congress has spoken very clearly on the issue. And it's a preemption argument, which this Court has dealt with plenty of times. It's an argument that the government is preempted from certain charges because Congress has expressly stated a clear intent that they only prosecute under this offense. And that's generally done in sentence enhancers. And that's all the cases that appellants cited for that proposition were when the government charged one thing and tried to enhance the sentence with another crime. That's not what happened here. Here there is a general intent offense, as this Court pointed out. I believe it was Judge Sparks' question. And as the Supreme Court acknowledged, for example, Justice Thomas in his dissent of Marinello said very clearly that mens rea is important in determining whether something is mere surplusage. For example, a higher mens rea, such as a specific intent crime, could carry with it a more significant punitive burden. So for that reason, just in and of itself, there is not surplusage when the Congress creates similar offenses that could overlap and attack the same offense at times, but one may have a higher mens rea.
Counsel, assuming that Congress is thinking ahead, let's think ahead. If we were to agree with you, would the government ever charge anybody with lack of consent because of intoxication or being asleep? Why wouldn't they just always charge without consent? I mean, wouldn't that just sort of render it silly to try to prove without consent because you could always bring the same evidence in and then, in fact, you wouldn't even have to distinguish between sleeping or being intoxicated or anything else. You could just always charge with a general offense. And it just seems like that. Why would Congress have set up a system like that?
A few responses to that, Your Honor. Firstly, there are certainly hypotheticals, and that's not this case before the Court today. And the government was about to launch into some of the facts that we think is proof of non-consent, such as the victim stating she never would have consented under these circumstances when she was menstruating. She never would have consented while she had a tampon in. That would have caused...
Those facts seem to suggest that she would not have consented if her blood alcohol level wasn't so high.
Your Honor...
Is that the other half of that sentence?
No, Your Honor. I believe that she's saying she wouldn't have consented to being penetrated while she had a tampon inside of her because that would cause her pain. And, of course... that she, although she doesn't remember what occurred, that was certainly evidence to her that she did not consent to the accident.
I thought all of her testimony, much of it, and most of it, was that I wouldn't have if A, or I wouldn't have if B, I wouldn't have if C, but saying I wouldn't have kind of pretends to hide behind the fact that she is actually highly intoxicated.
Yes, Your Honor. And admittedly, the victim was not the star witness in this case. She was completely blacked out drunk, as she testified to. So the fact that she would not have was merely one brick in the government's case. And the government can point to examples within the military rules of evidence, such as 406 habit evidence. Although it wasn't the most probative element of the government's case, it was certainly some evidence that the victim did not. And that was the government's theory at trial: would not, could not, did not consent. But additionally, I think the government's star witness was the appellant himself. Now, of course, the appellant argues today, well, hey, he admitted to everything and he was consistent. They say that in their brief. But it's important that when the government was analyzing the facts of this case, what they saw was an appellant who lied for 3 hours and 15 minutes that sexual acts never occurred. There's an appellant who mentioned 8 times he didn't remember anything occurred. The actual substantive interrogation only lasted 4 hours. So there was only 45 minutes of the appellant actually admitting that sexual acts occurred. And when he finally did admit that sexual acts occurred, he said that she was the aggressor, he simply didn't resist. And then it devolved to, well, I was in control the whole time. And then eventually, yeah, she didn't say yes to this or that. So the government had a theory that was based on the appellant's, under Quezada, false exculpatory statements. And Judge Maggs, I do want to get back to your question, sir. I'll get there in just one moment. But the government had a theory that the victim was in and out of consciousness throughout that event. This was mixed facts. This was a set of facts where there was both incapable of consenting, and while she was conscious, the government believed that she did not consent, and that aligned with what she said, the injuries in her SANE report, her demeanor afterwards as well. So the court need not reach this issue, and in accordance with United States v. Guardiola, if it's outside the scope of the issue granted, the court need not address this issue, and the government's not asking this court to make a broad ruling to say today that you can always charge incapable of consent under without consent based on the plain language of the statute. The government would point out that the plain language of the statute is quite clear, and that Pease addressed the issue of competency, and Congress saw it fit to leave that definition within the definition of consent. So there certainly is significant overlap.
I'm not quite sure I understand your point. You're saying this court would not need to make that broad pronouncement, but if we were to find that the offense here is legally sufficient, wouldn't we at least sub rosa be saying to the outside world, to every trial counsel that's out there, you can proceed just as they did here?
Not necessarily, Your Honor, because the government's contention here is that there was mainly but alongside, so consistent with
it. I'm sorry?
That there was mainly evidence of intoxication, but that it was alongside evidence of non-consent as well, or evidence of an absence of consent.
What you're articulating is the U.S. v. Roe standard. Correct.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. All right.
And that's currently the law that the government considers ourselves bound by. That is our jurisdiction until this court says otherwise. So the government's position is that this court need not make a broader ruling today. However, Your Honor, to circle back to your question, there are certainly hypotheticals where the only reasonable charge would be for the government to charge incapacity. For example, if there was a situation in which both parties admit that there was some manifestation of consent, but the sole issue was the validity of that consent. That would be a set of circumstances where the government, I don't know about a legal sufficiency standard, but certainly a preemption standard. If the only element that the government is focused on proving is the new or reasonably should have known, then certainly that would be a situation where the government should charge something such as incapacity versus without consent.
How does that square with your argument, though, that, well, I think this is the argument you just recently made. We've got the offense of without consent, and then in the definition of consent, a person who lacks capacity cannot consent. I mean, wouldn't that argument seem to suggest you could, just to be consistent with your argument, you could charge even the offense that you suggested as without consent?
Certainly, Your Honor, there is some consistency when we look at the plain language of the statute. And the government's position is that here, on these facts of this case, this court need not decide that issue because there was evidence of both. However, if this court were to address that issue and this court did give plain meaning to the words of the statute, that is certainly one reasonable outcome, and the government does not believe that that would be outside of the congressional intent. The mere canon of surplusage, the mere fact that there may be overlap to the point where you could always charge one thing, does not render Congress's plain language or plain intent irrelevant. So the canon of surplusage only comes in when there is some real ambiguity as to what Congress is saying. But based on Pease and the plain language that Congress used, and to bring up Appellant's 120 Charlie argument, they quote United States National Bank case to say one proposition, but that case also says that where something means one thing in one part of the provision, it should mean the same thing in another part of the provision. So 120 Charlie, they concede, means without consent under all of those circumstances. Congress drafted that in 2012. In 2016, they wrote in without consent into this part of the statute as well. So the notion that they would mean one thing in 2012 and then write the exact same words 4 years later but mean something totally different doesn't have much of strength for that argument. So the government's position is that the plain language is clear and that this Court need not go beyond that analysis to try and determine if the canons of surplusage kick in because of how clear that language is. Your Honor, appellant's interpretation additionally would create surplusage. Now, appellant in their brief said that affirmative non-consent is required. And appellant has walked that back or clarified their understanding here before this Court. But essentially, that is what they are asking for, that all surrounding circumstances are not to be considered. So that a lack of consent requires some proof of affirmative non-consent. And I believe in their brief they mentioned, well, she has to at least say that she was not consenting in her mind. That is language that would have to be added into the statute, that this Court would have to add in order to find that the government could not charge under one theory, it would have to charge under another theory. And the canon of surplusage, although it is strongest when it makes an entire provision superfluous, it is not to be given effect when it renders other parts of the statute superfluous as well. And the government's position is you'd have to render portions of the statute, the definitions of consent, superfluous, or say they simply don't apply to without consent in order to accept appellant's argument. And this Court should not do that. As the Supreme Court has stated time and time again, we may not like the way Congress has drafted or wrote something, but that is Congress's problem to fix if there is, in fact, a problem at all. And certainly creating redundancies within criminal statutes is not something outside the wheelhouse of Congress, not something that is unconstitutional, and if anything, shows Congress's intent, which is, of course, clear from our common sense and ways of the world, that they wish to capture all aspects of criminal non-consent sexual offenses. That was the goal in changing from bodily harm to without consent, and that is the goal in having such a detailed statute that addresses these issues. I'd like to speak briefly about Riggins, Your Honor. Appellant seized on that single footnote, and I believe Judge Johnson brought up some of the other parts about it, but I would just like to distinguish that case. Of course, similar to Sager, Your Honor, Riggins was addressing a situation in which one thing was charged, sexual assault by fear of harming someone's career, and then last minute, the judge said, hey, how about this lesser-included offense of assault consummated by battery? Of course, that created significant notice issues. And of course, that was, because this Court found it was not a lesser-included offense properly, that was an improper finding that deprived appellant of due process, of a different defense he could have put on. None of that is present here, and the facts are extremely different here. Firstly, here, the appellant was found guilty of what he was charged with. For Riggins to even be somewhat compelling, we'd have to find that the government charged, for example, sexual assault by incapacitation, but was found guilty of without consent. That would be a direct analogy to Riggins, and that's not what occurred here. Appellant was charged with without consent. The government put on evidence that she was not only incapable, but that she did not consent, and the government relied on appellant's false exculpatory statements, the victim's statements that she never would have consented under those circumstances, and other circumstantial evidence, such as the fact that there was no prior relationship. So none of the notice or due process issues are present here in this case. And just a few more points to your question, Judge Maggs, about the Supreme Court has expressly stated things to the effect of surplusage does not always produce ambiguity, and our preference for avoiding surplusage constructions is not absolute. And the government would just offer that quote from Miami v. United States v. Treasury, 540 U.S. 526, for that very suggestion that, hey, if this is somewhat superfluous, does that mean that has to that we have to give different meanings to the plain language of the statute? And the government's position is that this court does not. And then to further back up the government's point regarding congressional intent, in Ali v. Federal Bureau of Prisons, the Supreme Court specifically stated that seemingly redundant or superfluous language in the statute shows congressional intent to remove any doubt as to Congress, what Congress intended to criminalize. Lastly, Your Honor, Congress could have intended different punishments for this offense. However, Congress does not set the maximum punishments. The President does, and there's no minimum punishments that are set. So, of course, a military judge or a panel is free to consider a higher mens rea when determining that a certain offense is worthy of a higher punishment. For all those reasons, we believe that even if this Court found that they were always overlapping, that there was a perfect overlap between without consent and incapable of consent, the language would not be superfluous. And even if they did find that it was superfluous, that should not be a reason to alter or impact congressional intent and the plain language of the statute where Congress has spoken clearly. In sum, this Court need look no further than the evidence presented at trial and the plain meaning of the statute to affirm the findings and sentence. Any other questions?
Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Captain Fields.
A few points, Your Honor. First, Pease is not included in the definition of consent. The government contends that it is, but no accused who's charged with sexual assault without consent gets the Pease instruction. Pease it falls under the incapable of consenting, and the language included in the definition of a consent is incompetent. Appellant agrees that if Congress meant these things to mean the same thing, they would have used the same words. They don't. One says incompetent, and one says incapable. Those have to have different meanings. Second, with regard to the government's argument about the language in the consent definition requiring consideration of all the surrounding circumstances, consistent with this Court's precedent in Sager, I would analogize that to the otherwise unaware portion. That is language that does have to have its own meaning. The surrounding circumstances does have to have their own meaning, but it has to be different than other enumerated portions of the statute. So what those surrounding circumstances have to mean are something other than incapable of consenting due to intoxication. Otherwise, that surrounding circumstances language causes the complete surplusage of the rest of the statute. And last, with regard to their specific facts that they point to the issue of when the alleged victim said she never would have consented and appellant not being forthcoming with CID. Those, as I said in my initial argument, were great proof of incapable of consenting due to intoxication. That she would not have done something but for the alcohol may very well be proof that she was so incapacitated due to alcohol that she could not consent. But they say nothing of the affirmative of the government's affirmative responsibility to prove that she did not, in fact, consent.
Counsel, may I ask you to respond to the government's answer to my question about whether there's a principle that whenever a general and specific statute speak to the same concern, the prosecutor must charge the specific offense. I understood the government to say that there is no such principle, that in each individual case it's just a question of preemption. That you'd have to look at 120 and decide, was there some reason that Congress would want to preempt this? Do you agree with that statement? You previously said there was such a principle. The government says it's no principle, it's just a question of preemption.
Your Honor, I do believe that's a principle of statutory construction. I think it was included in, if I'm remembering correctly, in Justice Scalia's canons of statutory construction. I think that it was the canon of specificity was highlighted in Simpson, and I think it was at issue in the recent decision by the Supreme Court in Dubin, that when two offenses, one general and one specific, that the government must charge the more specific offense, and that's why in Dubin the government had to charge Medicaid fraud, because that's what the accused there did.
Counsel, may I?
Please.
I understand your argument to be that even if Congress intended to create two separate offenses between without consent and incapable consent, the President's definition of consent that the President promulgates eviscerates the distinction between the two because incapable can always be without. So is that fair? Do I understand it correctly?
I think that the definition doesn't do – I think that applying –
Well, the President says it has to be by a competent person. My understanding is that pulls in all incompetent people, which is people who can't – who are inebriated or asleep or everybody else. But moving on, my question is, so if the President made a mistake by – with his definition of consent, blurring the distinction between two separate statutory offenses – What is the nature of that error, and like what do we call that, and how does that error seem to prejudice the appellant in this case?
Your Honor, I think that looking at this case, and which for what it actually is, a statutory construction case, this court should find that the facts are legally insufficient. And in through their ruling, offer what the definition of consent should be. And there's parts of that definition of consent that need to remain, the expression of lack of consent through words or conduct. It's some of the other language that causes that exact confusion. And in this case, the problem is that the government feels that it can take evidence of intoxication and spin that into without consent. And the problem is that they're doing it in a number of cases, even when clear evidence that only goes to incapacitation is the proper charge in that case.
Anything further? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you.
The case is now submitted. The Court thanks counsel for both sides. And the Court will stand in recess until 9:30 tomorrow morning.
All rise. The Court stands in recess until 9:30 tomorrow morning.